Glad to see you guys here, more than I expected at this hour of the morning. Just out of curiosity, how many of you are haven't gone to sleep yet, and that's how you made it here? Show of hands. All right, we've got a couple people. A smaller number than I would expect for Vegas. How many of you are here with less than 4 hours of sleep? All right, got more hands. And how many, let's say 5 hours. All right. So I was pretty devastated yesterday, so I went to bed early last night, and now I feel energetic and ready to give this talk. All right. Okay, it's 9 o'clock. I don't see anyone. I don't see a big line waiting, so let's get started. My name's Phil Hack, and I'm a program manager with Microsoft, and I'll be giving the ASP.NET MVC Ninjas on Fire black belt tips. Because ninjas can't catch you if you're on fire. So this expression, so this slide actually is not the embodiment of the expression that I've heard this used, and which was on Scott Hanselman was talking about one day where he's telling a coworker, you know, I'm really busy, I feel like I'm being chased by ninjas, and his coworker says, well, you know, are they on fire? And he's like, well, no. He's like, okay, well, you're not busy yet. So these tips are meant to help you to get from here to here, where when you're being chased by ninjas on fire, that you're able to get more done effectively with ASP.NET MVC. So this is a demo-heavy talk. I'm going to go through a lot of demos, one after another, just to set expectations clear. I expect that you know something about web development already, that you've done web development in one form or another. And this is not an introductory talk to ASP.NET MVC. However, even if you don't know MVC, I think you'll get a lot out of this. And I will be in third place afterwards, so you can come and ask questions if anything was not clear. So to give you a brief overview, these are the topics I'm going to cover. I'm going to show a demonstration of CSRF, or cross-site request forgery. And then I have I'm going to build upon Hack Overflow, which was a demo I did in my yesterday talk. Funny story about yesterday, I kept running into this weird problem where I kept launching the Windows 7 magnifier in lens mode. So I just found out that the keyboard shortcut for going to your Solution Explorer in Visual Studio, Control-Alt-L, on the build that I'm running also happens to be the keyboard shortcut for magnifier lens. So if you're wondering why I kept screwing up, that was it. So anyways, let's get it started. Okay, so now I just need to switch over here. All right, so you know, in this climate, we know that banks are to be trusted. These are the great place to store your money. And I wrote a bank site and called the Hack Bank and Casino. You can really trust us. And I just want to demonstrate that this is somewhat like what a typical bank site would work, except if you saw a bank site that was implemented like this, I would run away. So let's get started. For example, it's telling you what my login is. And my password is password. So this site shows me my balance, $3,000. I'm rich. And if you ever saw a site that showed you everyone else's accounts and their balance, that would be pretty bad. But remember, this is a demonstration. So let's just walk through the real simple, what does this site do? It allows me to transfer money to different accounts. So I owe my bookie $1,000. Apparently he's doing well. I hit transfer, and now my balance is $2,000 and his balance is $117,000. Okay, so we saw that I'm able to transfer $1,000. Let's take a look at the source code. So you see some distracting comments in here. So this is the home. I just did everything in the home controller. One thing you'll notice here is I have the authorize attribute on the controller level. So that applies. That requires authentication on every action method of the class. So if you ever use a principal permission attribute, that has a different semantic. So I just want to make this point clear. With principal permission, it's permission to even create the instance of the class. Action filters with MVC, putting it on the controller level is just a shorthand for applying to every single action. So we have a transfer method here, and I'll just step through the code real quick. I get the current username, I get the source account and destination account, and then I decrement and increment each account by the same amount. Now you'll notice I'm not bogging down the code with what you'd really do, which is wrap this in a transaction, obviously, and other things like that. If an exception occurred in between there, that'd be really bad. This is just for the sake of demonstration. And then I go in and I submit all changes. So in this example, I happen to be using link to SQL rather than link to entities like I did in my previous talk. And we redirect to the index. So you're looking at this and you're thinking, oh, well, we got this authorize attribute. That's great. I'm protected, right? Well, not quite. So let's happen to check my email. And I got this email the other day from, well, myself. And it says, hey, there's this really cool demo. Let's take a look at this link. This innocuously named hacked.com/demo/xsrf-iframe.html. Well, I better click on that. And notice that this is at a different domain. I'm running my site localhost. This site's a different domain, and I want to check out this really cool demo. I click on it, and it's like, oh, that's weird. I'm back at my site. And notice that my balance is 1,000 less. And bad guy, his balance is 1,000 more. So what just happened there? How did that happen? Well, there's a form of attack on the web called, known by CSRF or CSRF, or cross-site request forgery. And it's a variant of an attack called the confused deputy. So confused deputy essentially is, I don't need to go and get a gun and shoot you. I can just, if I can confuse a deputy to believe that you're the bad guy, then he'll do it for me. In this case, it's the opposite in terms of this other site is going on a limb hoping that I'm still logged into my banking site, and it's doing a form post to my bank site. And since I just happened to have logged in recently and my cookie is still valid, the browser is making that form post on my behalf using my cookie. Let's look at the bad guy code real quick. So I have a copy of that running. I have a copy of that running here. Let's take a. Okay, here we go. So this is really simple code. I have a form. Notice I've encoded the location of the action method that I want to post to on the other site, and then I just have a bit of JavaScript that submits the form. So some of you might be thinking, well, I thought you couldn't do cross-site requests with XML HTTP. But you'll notice here I'm not doing any kind of cross-site requests in the sense that I'm not using JavaScript to make that request. I'm just doing a form submission. And with a form submission, you can do cross-domain form posts, which, in my opinion, is kind of a bad thing in terms of the protocol. I wish that wasn't allowed by default. I wish you had to actively specify which sites are allowed to cross post to you. So what do we do to protect against this? Well, fortunately, MVC does come with something to help protect you. So we have this concept of an anti-forgery helper. So the idea is this. There's a piece of information that the bad guy, we're assuming that the innocent user is using a trusted browser. And trusted browsers won't let another domain get access to the contents of your cookie. So what we need to do is put another value, put a value in the cookie, and also put a hidden input value that the bad guy site couldn't possibly know. And then when we submit the form, we'll take the value from the cookie, we'll take the value from the hidden input, we'll compare the two, and we'll say, well, if they match, then this is a trusted form submission. And so the way that works is there's two steps you have to do, unfortunately. I'd like to reduce this to one or even automatic at some point. But as I mentioned in my previous talk, with MVC, you get more control, but also more responsibility falls on your shoulders to do these things. So let's take a quick look. So there's one aspect is I need to validate this token. So we have this validate anti-forgery token attribute. I just apply that to the action method. So what that attribute does is say when a post comes to this method, you need to look for a cookie and a hidden input and validate those two. So the next step is we need to go and put a value in the hidden input. So here's my form. We'll just toss something in here right after this little begin form. Anti-forgery token. So we have this helper method called anti-forgery token. Let's look at what that renders out. So did I compile? Let's see. See if I can find it. There it is. So you see this hidden input request verification token, and it has this base64 encoded value. So we just call into the underlying crypto APIs to encode this unique token, generate a random token, and encode it into the hidden input, and put it into your page. So now, let's go check my email again. I hope none of you sent me an email. That would have been a good time to do it, though. All right, so now when I click on this, oh, we get this exception message. This tells me, the end user, that, hey, somebody's trying to do some monkey business. I mean, then what I'd also do is probably put a custom error that looks for the, or custom error handler that looks for this exception to tell the user, hey, you should report whatever you did that caused this. So, So just as a recap, so that's CSRF, CSRF, cross-site request forgery. Not every single action method may necessarily need this level of protection, but if you were building a banking site, I'd definitely do it. Other mitigations are checking refer helps a bit, although sometimes you can't get the refer. I think in some cases with SSL, it may not be sent. The other thing I didn't mention is always require a post for your action methods. Did I do that? Let's take a quick look. So yes, I required posts. When you allow gets, you're even more open to attacks, various forms of this style of attack. Great. And like I said, if you have any questions on what I just showed, I'll be available in third place afterwards. So let's close my banking site. And we can close this too. All right, so, whoops, closing too. I'm trigger happy here. So let's go back to Hack Overflow. So one of the benefits that I always talk about with MVC is that it's a very testable framework. But in none of my demos up until now, I've never shown off how do you do a unit test of an action method, for example. So this is not going to be a demo of how to do TDD in the full, but I just want to show a really quick example so that I can show what I mean when I say that we're trying to make the framework testable. So I have this Hack Overflow site, and I started building this new feature of it that will allow you to create tags. And so I mocked up the UI real quick. Let's try this. So here's all the tags in the system, and I want to implement a feature that allows me to filter based on So what I type in. So when I hit ASP and I click filter, I would hope that would filter. So I haven't implemented it yet. I've just kind of faked out the UI a little bit. Let's go look at the code. Okay, let's not use the shortcut. So we have this index action method. I'm going to pass in a filter string. And then I'm going to do some code in here to actually filter the tags. So I've got the stub implementation just so I could show the UI, but right now there's nothing going on here. So let's write a unit test of this. So what I want to do in my unit test is think about what is the behavior that I want to spec out in a way. And the behavior I want is that when I give a filter, that the tags that are shown are filtered by that tag, right? So there's any number of ways I could name this. Sometimes I like to use a convention where I say, this is the method I'm testing, and when a filter is applied, it will return tags starting with filter. And I like to use these three. If you see Hanselman's talk, there's a little bit of repetition here because I didn't know he was also doing this. But I'm going to go a little bit, take a little bit different tack. So don't worry, I'm not going to repeat exactly what he said word for word. So I like to use these comments to remind me that there's really three stages to unit test. I want to arrange the initial condition, then do the actual action I'm testing, and then do an assertion that says, well, did the test succeed? And the key here is that I'm not doing quality assurance here, right? I haven't even written the method yet. What I'm doing here is thinking about how would someone else who wants to call into my API do that. So I'm thinking about the design of my code. So the first thing we're going to do is let's create some tags. So just new up a list of tags and maybe add one or two. Let's see. Tag name equals hello world. Yep. All right, so we've created our initial data. Now let's new up the controller here. So this is the controller I want to test. Sorry, what? Oh, tag controller. Thank you. And then this is the method I want to test, controller.index with a filter. I'll just do a simple one. And what do we want to get out of that? We want to get the action result as a view result. What do we want to do? Oh, we want to get the action result. Yes, view result equals this as view result. I think right now I have it as just redirecting or something, but what we really want is to return a view result, and we can look at the model data in there. result.viewData.model as a list of tags. And for now, let's just assert that the count is 1. We should probably also assert that it's the tag we expected, right? So if I pass in an A, what's the behavior? Well, the behavior I expect is that we'll get one tag, and it's the one that says, are you sleepy? Are you sleepy? Yes, I am. All right, so we've got a unit test. So let's run this real quick. There's something missing here, though. The question is, how do I get those tags into the database? Well, the thing is, with my unit test, I don't actually want to test against the database, right? I'll save the database testing for integration testing. I just really want to test the behavior of this action method, and I don't care where it gets its full list of tags. So there's a little bit of refactoring we need to do to make this test before we can finish writing this test. So let's write it as the way we would want to write it, and then we'll go and write the code to make it actually compile. So in this case, I'm going to use a pattern similar to what Hanselman did and what Rob Connery's written a lot about, where we abstract away the database from the implementation so that rather than calling it to link the SQL directory directly, I'm just going to call this interface that I created, which supplies me the data. And so I'm going to use I could go and write this interface, and then I could write a fake implementation for my unit test. But I tend to like to have all my test code in one method as much as I can. So I use a framework called MOQ or MOQ, and you can use it to dynamically generate implementations of an interface. So let's write the code, and it won't compile yet, but then we'll go and make it compile. So what I can do here is, repository equals new mock I tag repository. This is what I'll call it for now, and I might change my mind later. Excuse me. Ooh, those eggs. And what you can do with mock is you can set up a behavior on this object that you want to happen. So when somebody calls, what did I name it? Just want to make sure. We're going to add a tags property to this repository. Tags returns. Did I do this right? Repository.tags returns tags. And then we want to pass repository. Okay. So this is a little confusing because I haven't written the code yet. What this line does is this says, new up this repository object, and it's going to implement this interface dynamically. And then it's saying that this interface has a tags property. When somebody calls tags property on this fake instance, I want you to return all the tags that I created earlier. And then we're going to pass this thing into the tag controller. So we have to pass tag the repository.object. That's the actual implementation of the interface. So let's go make this interface. Whoops. Just add something to the models directory here. There we go. Yes. So this will be a very simple interface. We'll just have a tags property. List of tag. Tags get. That's it. So you can imagine in a real app we'll have a lot more on here, or we'll have a lot more repositories. So now this should. Oh, I got it. I know what I did wrong here. So it's a little. It's not as simple as this. I need to use a lambda here. So we'll just use r. Such that repository tags returns tags. Okay, I tag repository, which I. I'm sorry, what? Oh, yeah. Good point. So this is a lambda expression. I declared the variable name to be r, so I need to use the same variable name, surprisingly. Well, not surprisingly, if you actually know what you're doing. All right, and we just. Take this tag controller and let's refactor this to take in a tag repository. And instead of using this data context, we're going to get rid of that guy. Instead, so a little refactoring here. Not a huge change. Okay, so we've got a building. We've done just enough code to make this test pass. In fact, what this really ought to say is throw new not implemented exception, right? We're not ready to implement this yet. We just want to make sure that our test runs. So I just hit Control R, Control T, which will run this test in the debugger. It's not what I meant to hit, but. Yes. So I'm using MS test, and they want test method. There we go. Control R T. There we go. So we run this test, and it fails. And that's good, because we want to make sure that the test can fail. I've written tests where I went too far too fast, and test passed, and I thought I was good, but then I realized that I had made it so that test could never fail, and that's not a good thing. All right, so let's implement this method and make it work. It's going to be very simple. We're just going to get this repository, get all the tags, and now we'll give it another lambda expression. So t such that t dot starts with, t dot tag name starts with
filter.
This is the behavior. And this is going to give me resulting filtered tags. And then we'll return a view that has those tags. Did I mess up? My parentheses count's off by one. All right, there we go. Oh, and the unit test still fails. What happened? System null reference object. Oh, yep, that's right. One last thing. Oops. So this where returns IEnumerable tag. So we want to call the toList extension method on it, so that we return it as a list. One of the reasons you want to do that, especially with linked to SQL, is that the actual SQL is not yet evaluated until you run the expression. So now, and this is why we're not only doing TDD, but we're also doing pair programming for large numbers of pair. All right, we get the test succeeding. So hey, I'm done, I can go home. Well, not quite. Now we actually have to implement it in real life, right? So the tag controller here requires this dependency, iTag repository. And our default controller factory, when it wants to instantiate this, it's expecting a controller that doesn't have any parameters, parameterless constructor. So one thing you could do is take a controller factory, hook up a DI container, and if you're interested, I can talk about that in third place, about one example of doing that. For the sake of this app, since my dependency management, I only have one dependency so far, it hasn't quite reached the point where it's unmanageable. So I'm going to use what I call poor man's DI, or poor man's dependency injection, and just override tag controller to have a default constructor. And this.new, let's call it SQL tag repository. And that's all I need. So now we need to go implement SQL tag repository. This won't take us long. All right, so we've implemented this. Now let's do a little integration testing just to see what happens, because I haven't obviously implemented it. So great, so we're now calling into the real tag repository on the website, and I can just new up a hack overflow data context. Now I probably really should implement this as iDisposable and blah, 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 but I'm being irresponsible today because we are in Vegas. Unfortunately, this video does not stay in Vegas. .tags.toList. Oh, one point. I just realized the other mistake I made. What I really want that tag repository to implement is not list of tags. I want it to implement iQueryable of tags. That way, yeah, because I realized the mistake I made here. Let's change this around real quick just to make a key point. When you're dealing with things like linked to SQL, with iQueryable, it's not going to evaluate that expression until I call toList later down the road. So if we go in and fix up this test now, as queryable, did I not? Yes. So I need the linked namespace for all those really cool extension methods against the IEnumerables. So this sees everything. So that's gonna, that's right. And let's look at the controller real quick. Right, did I go to the wrong controller? Tag controller, there we go. Just want to double check my work, yes.
to list.
Great. So I just did a refactoring. Let's make sure that my unit test still passes. Okay, great. And now let's make sure that the site now works. All right, so it works. Let's clear the filter. Let's try another one. Let's just try A. Great. So this is one example of how you can integrate test-driven development or writing unit tests into your MVC application development and separate out the data access and the infrastructure needs from testing the behavior of your specific action method. All right. All right, so for the next demo, we're going to look at take a slightly deeper look at model binding real quick. This is a real short tip. So did I hit? Oh. You have to select the website, then hit Control F5 if you want to run it. I think I just ran all my unit tests again. All right. All right, let's do this. All right, so this is the result of my last talk. This is where we left off. Let's go in and edit one of these questions. And I'm going to... Oh, here we go. Edit. So this form allows me to edit the title, the votes, and the body. Now, there's a field that I just happen to know about of a question called views. Views equals 1,000. So I'm going to refresh that, put that in the query string, and let's submit this. Did I just change the view count? Now let's go back to this question. Let's go home. Wow. Whoops. Got really fat fingers. Can't hit these buttons right. All right. So you notice there, I just changed the number of views. That's really odd. Well, how did I do that by doing a query string? That sounds like that would be a bit of a security flaw. And it definitely is a flaw in the design of my application. So let's take a look at what I'm doing. And I bring this up because a lot of samples you'll see, for the sake of being really clear and simple, will take this approach that I'm doing, and then we forget to say, well, you know, don't do this in a real application. So let's see. Okay, so in this, here's the implementation of the edit method. I'm using a different approach than I've done before. You notice here we have this try update model call on here. And we just, hold on a sec. Yep. We just call try update model, and we don't specify which fields on that object to allow editing. So one way to fix this is to call one of these overloads, such as this one, and specify the set of properties that you want to allow updating. Now, there's another approach you could take. Some people like to use the model binding, okay? So instead of doing this approach, they would do something like this. Some magic here, submit changes. Now, the problem with this approach is I'm actually allowing you to take a form post and serialize it into one of your actual model objects, and then we're going to save that. That's a recipe for disaster if there's properties on here that you didn't want anyone to set. So one thing you might do is, instead of passing in the actual question, you might have some sort of like data transfer object or a model. And this might be like a different object, question model, that only has properties that you want to allow someone to bind to, and then you would just read those properties into your actual question object. Another approach, and I really think it's a matter of preference, is to use the bind attribute. So with the bind attribute, you can say, these are the fields I want you to allow editing. Title and body. So let's move this to a new line. So with the bind attribute, this gives you an indication of, this is a way for you to control when this form data is being, and it's not just form data, it's route data, form data, query string, is getting serialized into this parameter to my action method. Here's how I want you to control that. I want you to only allow including this. So this is a whitelist approach. A blacklist approach is you can exclude, and you also have the option of setting a prefix if you want, which is, in many cases, not really necessary. So keep that in mind when you're doing model binding. So now you're wondering, like, should I implement this question, but we'll do that in a sec, because I want to show one more thing. Let's go back to the original question. So let's talk about concurrency, something that a lot of times we don't really think about a whole lot. Now let's edit this. By the way, every time I do that, I think that's such a cool feature of Windows 7. The only problem is when you're on a dual monitors, like you can do one on one end of the one and one on the other and the other. I haven't figured out how you can do them both on one monitor if you have dual, but works great for demos. So here we have two questions. And on the left side here, you know, we can imagine that's Alice looking at that. And on the right side, we have Bob. So let's see what happens when Bob goes in here, changes this to 16. Now, Alice over here doesn't know that Bob just made this change. She's still looking at an older view of this data. This data is no longer in sync with what's in the database. But it's common to how many applications are written. If she decides that she wants to change it to, you know, 19, and she submits it, when we go back, we'll see that, let me go home here, we'll see that the end result is 19 votes, right? So we completely ignore the fact that someone changed the data while we weren't looking. So in many cases, that's fine, right? If I'm at if the site I'm building is my, you know, Facebook profile editor, I have a reasonable assumption that there's only one of me and I'm the only one who's going to be editing it, and I'm not going to be editing it in two different screens at the same time. So there's a reasonable assumption when for a lot of interfaces that are just single user. But for a site like Stack Overflow or Hack Overflow, there's a real community aspect to it. It's much like a wiki. Other people can come in and edit a question when they have a high enough status. So we really need to take concurrency a little more seriously than what I've shown here. So how do we do that? Well, typically, there's one way you can do it is you can serialize all the original values as hidden inputs into the form, right? And so when the form post comes back into the action method, you look at the original values, you take the current values that were submitted, and then you look at the values in the database, and you do this check. Are the values in the database the same as the values in the original? Well, if they're not, that means that somebody changed the database record while I was, you know, looking at the screen. If they're exactly the same, it's possible someone changed it, but it doesn't matter because they changed it to the original state anyways. And so my edit is still valid. But that's a lot of extra data to put in a form. There's a neat feature of SQL Server, for example, that you can have a timestamp column. So this is the approach I'm going to take, and I'm going to show you how you can do it with link to SQL. And there's a similar approach for link to entities as well. So let's open up the database. Do it on time. Good. We're going to go into question here, yes. So I have this timestamp column. Every record is unique and stamped with this time, and I just called it concurrency stamp. When I generated my link to SQL model, let's zoom in here. Oh, did you see? Let's try that again. Alt, enter. Oh, I see. I moved my mouse all the way to the right, got rid of that. There we go. So let's move to... Oh, I know what I did. Property. concurrencies. Here we go. Sorry about that. Okay, great. So we're looking at the concurrency stamp property. When you add a timestamp column, one thing we do is we set the update check to always. And what that means is that it's always going to check this value against what's in the database. So when you submit a record, you want that value needs to be the same as the one in the database. Otherwise, we're going to throw this concurrency exception. When I have a timestamp, I can go and set all the other ones. For example, if we look at title and go to properties, we can see that the title. We can see that the timestamp is false and the update check is never. So now we don't need to check all the other values against their original values to make sure that it hasn't changed. So let's take advantage of that and make this actually work. So now I'm going to go back to that approach I was mentioning earlier, where instead of using the try update model, I'm actually going to use a model binder, and we're going to have this question. I'm not going to use the bind attribute here, just for the sake of demo. So this question, again, represents the state of the form that I'm submitting to the action. What we need now is we need a value that represents the original form, a proxy, if you will. And so I have this original question. I'm just going to new up. And what's nice about this approach is I don't have to go back to the database. I have all the information I need at hand. So I'm going to give it the question.id and I didn't specify property, sorry. Yes. These newfangled features of C# will tell you. Concurrency stamp. Did I do that right? New question, blah, blah, blah. Wow, that is weird formatting. Okay, so this instance here effectively represents the value of the question in the database. And I'll show you why in a second. So all we need is the primary key, which would not have changed because we're doing edit, and we have this concurrency stamp. So this is something I need to put in the form so that when it comes back, I have the original concurrency stamp. And then this can be a stand-in for the original value. And now what I can do is I can attach this instance, questions.attach. And so I have the question, which represents the new values, and I'll call this overload here. So notice here the original, and I'll use my original question. So sometimes I'll name that proxy, or original proxy, because it's sort of a stand-in for the original. It's not the actual original. It doesn't have all the values. And then I can submit the changes. So what's left to do? Well, I need to go in and make one change to my view. Question, edit. And we need to render out a hidden input that has the value of the concurrency stamp. Oh, so when you have a timestamp column, linked to SQL in the model will generate a type of binary for that property type. Now, you'll notice here that I have this overload that actually accepts the binary for hidden input. So that's not in System Web MVC DLL. That's not in version 1.0. One of the things I had to do beforehand, which I didn't show you, is go and reference one of our futures assemblies. So I talked about this before. You can grab this from codeplex.com/ASP.NET. We put a lot of the stuff we're thinking about for the future up there, and I referenced microsoft.web.mvc. Not only that, I went into web.config, the root web.config, down to this namespaces section. Notice this under pages, there's the namespaces section, and I added microsoft.web.mvc. So now all the extension methods available in microsoft.web.mvc are available to me in the view. And so I had written an extension method that would accept a SQL binary as a hidden input and do the proper base64 encode. So let's take a look at that. So we've got to call model, model.concurrency stamp. Now let's refresh this. Okay, so you notice here we have this input of a concurrency stamp that's hidden, and it has this little base64 encoded value. So the final thing we need to do is, as I mentioned, SystemWebMVC doesn't know what to do with this base64 encoded string. So when it's trying to do this model binding, where it goes through and it's looking at a question object, it's looking at form fields, it gets to the concurrency stamp column. It says, this is a SQL binary type. I have this funky string. How do I convert this funky string into a SQL binary? It doesn't know how to do that by default. But we can add a model binder to do that. And we do that in global ASAX. So by default, we have this default model binder. And it has a lot of smarts in trying to take a form submission and serialize it into object. But it doesn't know about every single possible type. So we can write our own custom model binders, and this is what I did and put in the futures, that says, hey, when you see this new funky type and you get this value from the request form, this is how you take that value and put it into that type. Binders dot. So we call model binders dot binders dot add, and we're going to specify type, and that's binary, which is that link binary. And then we're going to say, I want you to use the new link binary model binder here. So now it knows how to take that concurrency stamp and actually bind it. So let's do this again. There's one more step here. So we've got this edit post. Now I want to add a handle error filter. So when this change conflict or this concurrency exception occurs, I want to give the user a nicer message than this yellow screen of death. So I can use this handle error attribute and specify view here. And let's make sure I have that view in my shared directory. So I've created this ahead of time. We'll compile that. Now let's see what happens when Alice and Bob try to edit the same record. Change conflict exception. Thank you. You guys can be my pair programming partners anytime. It's one of the reasons I got involved in open source is that you put it out there and then everybody tells you how awful and wrong your code is. It's great. All right, so we're both looking at the same version. So Bob, who's always quick to the gun, changes this to 190 votes. And, wow, let's see what happened there. Let's make sure I refresh both. So let's try that again, 190. One way to prevent change conflicts is just to never allow them to change it. Okay, that looked like that worked. I think I just didn't refresh that, so it didn't have that hidden input in there. And let's go back in here. Okay, we have 190 votes. So now we know Alice is out of sync, and she decides she just wants to increment it by 120. And using votes as an example is probably not the best I could have come up with, but it's what I did in the time I had. And we get this one other step. So one of the most, and which leads to my mini tip, one of the most confusing things about using the handle error attribute is that when you're running in localhost, you still get the yellow screen of death. And the reason why is that we gave the handle error attribute the same semantics as custom errors in web.config. So if you've ever used custom errors, I'm in the wrong web.config. Mini tip number two. Go to the right web.config. So the yellow screen of death is controlled by this custom error. So we gave it the same syntax. So I turned off all custom errors, so that's why the handle error attribute doesn't actually work. If I turn this on, now when she tries to submit this form, it worked. Wait. All right, let's redo this real quick. Okay, so 21, submit. She's looking at an outdated one. She tries to change it to 22. Ah, there we go. Yay. So now your user knows that, hey, you know, someone changed the value. You might want to refresh. I mean, an even better experience, obviously, is let's integrate AJAX in there so that when something changes, it even shows up on her screen so she doesn't have to submit the form. But that's for another conference. All right. So one of the things you might notice is that I'm using all these funky strings to do these edit views. Me, I'm a fan of strings. I mean, my whole professional career has just been producing strings to send to a browser, right? But there are times where I run into things where I was like, oh, what are the properties on that model? I wish I could remember. And it'd be nice if I had some strongly typed way of binding, creating these little text boxes against the actual model. And so one of the things that we've included in the MVC futures is a few samples of what we call expression-based helpers. And with expression-based helpers, you pass in a lambda expression of what property you want to render a text box for example. And then we just look at that expression and figure out and render out the proper HTML. So instead of HTML.textbox, what I do is this. It's fat fingers again. You'll notice here that, I have textbox 4. Again, this is in the futures assembly. So now I can do this funky thing where I pass in a lambda expression. So m such that m dot title. And now I get IntelliSense support, which is nice. Like, oh, what are the properties of the thing I'm trying to bind to? Oh, well, there's title. So I could do that, and then I could pass in these HTML attributes as well and produce exactly the same output. So let's get rid of this old guy. Out with the old, in with the new. And we see nothing's changed. Yay. Nothing's changed in the output, but the experience of using these helpers have changed. And so this is something we're considering about. We may consider bringing these into the core in some future version. We want to see how people respond to them. For example, some people look at this and it just reads so naturally. For others, they look at this and it's like, what is this garbage? I don't understand. And in case you don't understand lambda expressions, in this case, the way we're using it is just a way to specify title. So you almost don't need to understand fully. You just know there's some gunk here, and then this is what I want to, submit. This gunk here is I'm just specifying a variable name. It's almost like, object m equals, and then on the right side, I call a property of that variable name. So this letter here could be anything. I could make it A, and then it becomes A, and there's not a problem there. So if you're wondering what that is, I'm sure most of you probably know expressions and lambda expressions back and forth. So great. So I talked about the benefits of that is the strong typing. If you're using in some future, unfortunately, Visual Studio doesn't give you refactoring support in the views, but you can use third-party tools like ReSharp or CodeRush, and then when you refactor, change the name of that property, it will refactor it in the view. All right. So. That's really cool. We got these expression-based helpers, and I'd love to use them everywhere, but those darn add view dialogs always use the string-based approach. So how do we change that? So I mentioned in my previous talk the location of the T4 templates. It's in this really easy to memorize location: C program files, Microsoft Visual Studio 9, Common 7 IDE, item templates, C# Web MVC, or VB Web MVC for your VB.NET developers. And in the add view directory, we have these, let's get rid of this artifact from my last one. We have these templates. Now, these templates are global, right? Once you add a template here, it shows up for everything you do on this particular machine. What if you want to override these templates on a per project basis. Well, you can take the code templates here and copy them into the root. And just hit cancel here. So we're working on to fix the project system so it doesn't do this. This is something where, because we're an out-of-band project, we couldn't quite make changes to Visual Studio Core to make this experience better. So in the next version, though, you know, hopefully we'll get that resolved. So when you're doing per project, it's a little wonky. Now, the thing is, you might not even need to copy all of them per project, because I'll show you that you could just copy just the ones you want to change or just new ones. The other thing you have to do is you notice here that immediately it tries to do this, it tries to actually generate an output. And this is just a feature of Visual Studio. When you add a .tt file and you type something in there, it'll immediately generate the CS. But we don't want it to do that because ASP.NET MVC's tooling support, the add view, is actually hosting the T4 templates, not, we don't want Visual Studio to do it. So what I do here is I have to go through each one in properties and clear out the custom tool. So this is important. This is only if you really need to have per project code generation templates. You could always do it in the root and not deal with this, but I just wanted to show you the full story here regarding this. All right. So see, I think I did that everywhere. Let's go to Solution Explorer. So great. So what's cool here, though, is I can add my own templates. Let's just add some random text file. You notice that there's no dialogue for T4 templates, by the way. It's like one of these hidden gems of Visual Studio that they've tried really hard to make sure no one knows about. So hopefully, you know, we'll get better support for that. Test.tt, let's try that. So again, hit cancel, properties, and clear this out. And when I go to a controller, we'll just pick a random controller here. Control M, Control V. Oops. Missed it. Control M, Control V, which is not currently available. Oh, I'm in the constructor. Okay. We can see that that template shows up immediately. Now, these other ones I've overridden, so these are my per project ones. And one cool thing is that we can intermix. I can go in here and add a template. Let me just copy this. We have to rerun the dialog, of course. And we'll see that I have the one that I added to the root and the one that I added per project all in there. So let's go in and let's change the edit template. So I've got the syntax highlighting there. I got Daniel Casalino was generous and gave me a license to Claris T4 editor. When you open a TT file in Visual Studio, by default, you just get a black on white text. It's just a notepad style file. It's just a text file. With the Claris T4 editor, you actually get syntax highlighting, which is really cool. Now, this is some gnarly stuff to look at, because we're talking about code that's generating markup. So sometimes it's it really breaks your head. So what I'm interested in here is taking these text box, and we're going to use the lambda-based expressions. So m such that m dot property key and so on. Validation message for, let's do that too. Whoops. M such that m dot. Just have to be very careful here. Save that. So now I've edited the edit template. So the next time I go in here, let's go to the views and question edit. We'll just delete the edit view. And let's regenerate that edit view, which means I need to go to the question controller, edit, and control M, control V. So wow. So again, this edit is the one that I have in my local project. And now we see that my page is generated with all with the strongly typed helpers. And if I refresh that, I get an error. Great, what happened? Ah, yes, I generate off the edit post action. Okay, that's a good point. Okay, great, so it still works. Now I'm able to edit this form, and now I showed you an example of customizing the scaffolding to fit the style of development you like. All right, so let's go into validation. So one of the other examples we have on the CodePlex site, and I just want to show you this real quick. Validation with the out-of-the-box system web MVC is a little tricky in that we don't have any support for the new data annotations. So dynamic data is the first to ship these data annotation, which are attributes that you put on your model, and then it does this validation for you based on that. So if you go into MVC and go into find the latest release, the source code release, let's see, I think it just might be up here. Oh, they changed the interface. That's interesting. Okay, here we go. The MVC 1.0 source. We have this other sample here called the Data Annotations Model Binder sample. So I'm going to show you a quick demonstration of this. So first of all, there's two references I need to add. And I have them conveniently available here. Microsoft.web.mvc.dataannotations and system.componentmodel.dataannotations. The second one here, system.componentmodel.dataannotations, is part of .NET 3.5 SP1. However, I'm running a newer version that's included in that sample that I just showed you. This is part of our features for both dynamic data and MVC. And this is like crossover work. A lot of this stuff has been work that Brad Wilson, if you've heard his name before, has been working on. It's really cool stuff. So first thing we need to do is go back to the model binders registration. And in order to use this, we're going to need to replace the default model binder with this new model binder. And this new model binder understands these attributes. So you notice here, I just added a model binder because this model binder is specific to the type. But for the default, there's a way to replace that. Appropriately, default model binder equals new data annotations model binder. Yes. Let's compile that. Okay, so now we have the power of data annotations. So let's look at how we can use that. So when you create a linked to SQL model, it generates all these classes for you. So we're going to take a look at the, let's see if I can find it here, the question class. So in the models, if you go into the code behind here, I don't think they call it code behind. You can see that we have this public partial class question. Now we don't want to go in here and muck around with the generated class, obviously. So what I'll do is I'll add a new partial class. Question. I'll also call this question. So public partial class question. So this class. Partial class is just a compiler trick, really. It's saying this, I just want to have part of this class implementation in another file so that the code gen doesn't muck with the changes I'm making to that. And what we do here is we need to specify a class that's going to contain the validation information for this class. This is a little funky, and this is going to get fixed. So right now, all the metadata is in attributes. But eventually, you can take those attributes and store them elsewhere, like in XML. But that hasn't been implemented yet. There's a long story about that. I can tell you in third area why that's so tricky. So the first thing we need to do is we need to specify what we call a buddy class. So this class, and the reason is that there's no such thing as partial properties where I can put an attribute on the property in another class. So either I put the attributes on the generated properties or use this buddy class technique. So I'll explain the buddy class technique right now, and then if you have any questions about that, we can talk about that later. Metadata, I think it's metadata. No, that's the wrong one. What's the name of this? Metadata. I'm blanking here. It's not that one. So I have a cheat sheet. Oh, you know what? Let's just do this way. System.web.mvc.data. No. System.componentModel.dataAnnotations.metadataType. That's it. All right. Ooh. All right, here we go. So metadata type. And what we do here is we specify the class that's going to have the metadata for this type we're working on. And so what I'll do is I'm going to actually use an inner class here. So product.question. So there's an example of how often I use Northwind as an example, which I'm trying to get away from, that I just assume that I'm dealing with the product class. And then I'll just use a private class metadata. Sure. Let's follow the framework design guidelines here. So I'm using a private inner class here. Brad showed me this technique. I kind of like this approach. And what I can do now is I can just specify properties of the same name, such as title, and I can add attributes to these. Title's required, and let's give it a string length that the maximum length is 10. For no apparent reason, and error message is don't be so verbose. Okay, and so what's another thing we can edit? Let's look at our user interface again. Oh. Okay, and let's just for the sake of example, let's pick one for votes. Int votes, and we'll say votes are required, and maybe range. So minimum is 0, maximum is 10. So now, if I just start typing in title here, so let's see, we compile, make sure I did everything. Let's submit the form. Ah, I bet you there's... All right. One other thing I need to do, question controller, is... So here's another mini tip. You notice I had this method, edit_post, and I use this action name attribute here to say that this is actually the action edit. That was because I had both the method signatures the same earlier. And that's just a limitation in C#. You can't have two methods that have the exact same name and signature. However, now that I changed the signature for that last demo, I can actually get rid of this, rename this to be edit. I don't need that action name attribute. So one of the things I need to do here now is if the model state is not valid, oops, let's add a not here. I just want to re-render the view. In fact, I'll just do it this way. I think that will work. Let's try that. So the title is too long. We hit save. Okay, and now we've got this specific validation. Don't be so verbose, and the field votes need to be between 0 and 10. Great. So this is using the MVC features. This is a way to use validation on your model and have it float up to the UI a bit. We haven't yet implemented where this validation happens with JavaScript. Now, the next step, though, is that, you know, not everyone speaks English in this world. You'd be surprised by looking at the computer science applications in general, but how do we make this friendlier to our friends in other countries who speak other languages? such as the most widely spoken language in the world. I just want to show this. I thought this was funny. What is the world's most popular language? French, Spanish, English, or JavaScript? All right, so one cool thing with the data annotation is that we can actually, instead of specifying an error message, we can specify a resource. So what we need to do in here is go into Project Properties, and you notice on the Resources tab, this project doesn't contain a default resource file, so we'll just click that to create one. And let's say string length title verbose error is the name. Do título es más grande. All right, Miguel, are you in here? Is that right? No, he's not here. So as close as my Spanish I can remember is. One little quirk here is notice that the access modifier here is internal. We need to make that public. This is a quirk with the current version. I think this may change in the future. And so, because what this does is this builds a strongly typed resource file. Now, when I go back to home question controller, I can go in here and let's see, what am I doing? Oh, no, I need to go to my question partial. Question.cs. There we go. And so instead of specifying an error message, what we'll do is we'll say error resource type equals type of, whoops, resource or res, is it? Darn it. This is the hardest part. I always forget what the type is that this generates. And it should be resources. Oh, yeah, that's right. It's in, I just didn't add the right namespaces, but if I just remember the type name, control dot adds the namespace for me. And then the error resource message name is, and what was it? Type. I have short-term memory here. Anyone remember what that was? It's like, I guess we can just go to the resource file. Title verbose error. Let's cut and paste that so I don't have to remember it. And then, let's see. Make sure I close all the right parentheses and everything. See, if it compiles, then it must work. Okay, great. So now when I submit this again, oh, still waiting. Great, now we get the error message from the resource file rather than from this hard-coded English error-only error message. My title is too large. Great. All right. So for my next tip is a real quick one. If you've ever done MVC, the default route is really nice for doing simple routing, but there are times where you're going to run into situations where you want to really control the URLs and you add a bunch of different types of routes. So it gets really tricky in terms of how do you, sometimes you get one route that matches and you really want another route to match. I put something on my blog. You can just do a search for route debugger, and I'll show you how to use it real quick here. It's called routedebug.dll. So you add a reference to that, and then in your global ASAX, after you register your route, so you just call this routedebug.rewriteRoutesForTesting. Now, at some point, I would love to integrate this into the framework so that it would be easy to turn this on and off and make sure that you never deployed it to production. So there's a... Oh, and then we need to specify all the routes, routetable.routes. And what this does is, if you're familiar with routes, routes specify URL patterns that match and then a route handler. And with MVC, you never really deal with it because you'll call it one of our helper extension methods, MapRoute. But what it's doing under the hood is it's saying, when this route matches, I want you to use the MVC route handler. And what my little method does here is says, no, let's go iterate through all those routes and replace that with my debug route handler. So now when I go to the site, let's just click this. Hack Overflow is gone, and I just get all these, I get this weird, funky debug. So let's actually take a look. Question, what is Hack Overflow Edit? Here's a good example. And the interesting part is this table down here, all routes. So this shows you every route's registered and which ones are matching. And the algorithm is that the first match is the one that you want, is the one that gets processed. So if you're ever in a situation where you're thinking, wow, I really thought I would call this action method, but it's calling that one, you go in here and sometimes you'll see this other route that you didn't expect to match is still matching, and maybe you need to add a constraint or something like that. Up here you can see what route data is happening. So we have this I have this concept of slug in this app. We have the action edit and the controller question. Now, the new feature I added recently is that, well, what about URL generation? One of the real cool things about routing is that it's not URL rewriting. It's actually taking that URL and calling a method in response to that. And it's bidirectional, unlike URL rewriting. So if I change during development, I wouldn't recommend doing this after you deploy, but during development, I can change my routes around. And if I'm using routing to generate all my URLs, everything just updates itself. So in this case, I created this real simple parameter, this real simple way of testing URL generation. So in this case, I'll provide question mark slug equals XYZ and answer ID equals 123. And I'm hoping that I'm going to generate. So I didn't generate quite the URL I expected, right? I got slash questions in this question parameter. And what I really want to generate is this one. And the problem is I'm missing the action. So, and action equals, I'm running out of time. Hello. So now I'm generating that based on the one I expected. All right, so that's it for the set of demos I want to show you. I'm going to have to wrap up here. That's B, I think it is. Great, nope. So for more information on this stuff, there's one demo that I hope to show, which was my most complex one. It's integrating jQuery Grid with ASP.NET MVC. I can show that off at third place if you're interested. So for more, you can go to these sites. In that demo, I show off Dynamic Link, which is this third-party library, jQuery Grid. I showed you mock, and I showed you my route debugger. So again, if you weren't, I had the same shameless book plug. You can get our book that talks a lot about MVC, a good way to learn it. You can get our extended forehead edition made by, this is a remix made by a fan of ours. And please complete your evaluation forms. Your feedback's important. It's just two questions. It's on your seat. And there's a gentleman in the back there who will collect them on your way out. So if you don't know what to put, just mark the one that said it was awesome. And thanks a lot.